Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
This is Radio K's Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Nathan Fervoy. Today, we're saying goodbye to our friend and host of RCP for the past year, Alex Schumacher. Alex, as students inevitably must do, is graduating this month and heading on out to bigger and better things out in the real world. If you've listened to the podcast at all in the past few years, it's likely you've heard Alex's voice as a volunteer reporter, producer, and eventually host of the show. We're going to miss him a lot here, but before he walked out of the studio for the final time, I sat down with Alex to discuss his favorite moments from his time here.
To the podcast initially.
I initially started my college career wanting to be a reporter for NPR. So I was like a journalism major. I was like, I'm going to be the next Terry Gross or whatever. And I found out the beginning, I tried to do some Radio K my freshman year and didn't really stick. Then I tried again my sophomore year and I heard there was a podcast. So I reached out, but then it finally clicked my second semester of sophomore year because former producer Emily Allen was in one of my classes. And I was like, yo, I want to get involved at the podcast. And she was like, great, I can help set you up. And so that's how I got started. And I did like a total of like, I think two pieces. And then they're like, we need new producers. And they like hired three at once. And apparently there was like quite a bit of competition for that. But I like tried out because I was like, whatever, I'll interview. But yeah, that's how I got involved here, and then I just stayed with it.
One of the first stories Alex put together was about the Minneapolis sex store, the Smitten Kitten.
It was really wild, and it was really fun, and it was good for someone who had no idea, like, essentially what I was doing. Everyone at Smitten Kitten was really inviting and helpful, and it just ended up being a fun piece. Like, I got to sit down with the owner and one of the workers in the basement, and then I got to get a tour of the store from another worker. And just like result in a bunch of fun audio of like, here's the penis section of the store. And like, I don't think I actually put that on there because I was like, this is too cutting edge, too edgy. But like, it was just a really fun piece to kind of put together because there was so much weird, unique audio. It wasn't like a boring journalism story.
Without further ado, the Smitten Kitten.
When you ask Jennifer Pritchett, the owner and founder of the Smitten Kitten, how the Smitten Kitten came to be a champion of non-toxic sex toys, they'll tell you that initially, that wasn't the mission of the store at all.
When we first started, it was really important to us to be an education-based sex toy store that was open and friendly to folks of all genders. Quickly after we opened, we had an unfortunate incident where we had a shipment of toys come to the store that were damaged by the heat of the summer. And it was through that process that we discovered the issue of toxic sex toys. That moment really was a catalyst for change for Smitten Kitten, where we went from wanting to be really a copy to really a focus on environmental justice, sex toy health and safety, and consumer advocacy within the adult industry.
Sarah Moeller, Smitten Kitten's lead education and research developer, talked about why toxic toys are even a thing and why it's important for stores like Smitten Kitten to demand non-toxic toys.
Sex toys aren't regulated by any agency or anything in the U.S. So that's part of why toxic toys and porous toys are an issue. We want people to be able to demand quality from their sex toys and from their lubricants, as opposed to just take what they can get if what they can get is leaking toxins into their body.
Because sex toys aren't regulated, Jennifer told me some stories she'd heard from customers about issues they've had with sex toys.
Once you start talking about this issue of sex toy safety, a lot of people have stories about having a cheap vibrator that caused burning or itching or a rash or like gelled together and melted to another toy in their drawer and all of these things, but nobody was talking about it. So once we sort of opened that door, a lot of people felt relief, I think, and oh yeah, that happened to me too.
Beyond providing non-toxic sex toys, Sarah talked about how another piece of Smitten Kitten's mission is educating consumers.
Part of the mission of the Smitten Kitten since it's been founded is a really strong focus on education. The more educated and insistent on quality the consumer is, the better the industry becomes.
Jennifer talked about some of the ways Sminkin encourages consumers to become more educated.
We also offer a free educational book lending library, which is really exciting. We have over 300 titles in the lending library, and at any given time, there's probably about 100 books checked out.
Later, Kat Hammond, the shipping and public events coordinator at Sminkin, gave me a tour of the shop. They showed me the lending library that Jennifer mentioned, as well as other sections in the store that move beyond what one would traditionally think to find at a sex store.
You come into the store, we have our lending library. So these are all nonfiction sex ed books that have been donated to us or that we've purchased if there's a popular title that we want to make sure to have. And these are available for anybody to check out for free for up to 2 weeks at a time. We have our gender expression section. These are mostly prosthetics of various kinds that are involved in gender expression. So we have Packers, prosthetic penis that folks can wear, some of which are STP or stand to pee Packers. We also have some breast forms that would be prosthetic breasts. We're walking past the card racks now. We have a butt ton of cute cards in here for a variety of occasions. So whether or not you're looking to buy some sex toys with your greeting cards, definitely please encourage folks to stop by for some adorable greeting cards.
Connecting all the different sections of Sminkin was a strong focus on both non-toxic products and free expression, a point which Kat hit on during the tour.
Everything squishy in this store that is designed to go inside a body is made out of silicone, because that's the only flexible material that's non-porous and sterilizable and hypoallergenic. You'll notice that I haven't identified any section by a particular gender, which sometimes folks come in and ask, where are the men's toys or where are the women's toys? And pretty much any sex toy could be used by anybody. And even if the ones that are designed for a certain body part or a certain anatomy, we like not to gender those.
Looking at Sminkin as a whole and all it offers for consumers in both Minneapolis and beyond, Sarah summarized why she felt what Sminkin does is so important.
I really do believe that we change people's lives, and that's because I've been told that by people whose lives I've changed, just by like getting them a lube that doesn't give them yeast infections or teaching them about their own genitals. So just making people comfortable in the store and seeing people come back and thank us for the work that we do it's pretty incredible.
From Real College Podcast, I'm Alex Schumacher.
One of the lasting impacts Alex will leave here at RCP is the increased focus on the personal truths that his stories explored.
Yeah. So the biking piece, one of the things I feel like has become like sort of my specialty at RCP has been doing like sort of personal essay type pieces, like things that like blend the line between like my own involvement and like hardcore journalism. I think that's sort of the direction I've taken the podcast overall. And that was like my first attempt at that. We were doing like a things I didn't learn in school. And I was like, fun fact, I don't know how to bike. And everyone was like, what? And I was like, yeah, I don't know how to bike. And they're like, that's a story. I'm like, okay, I guess that's a story. It was essentially just me, like, I went on a tandem bike ride with a friend. I was like, this isn't real biking. So I, like, went back home. And I have, like, great audio of my brother trying to teach me how to bike, but he's so antisocial and, like, just deadpan that it's my brother that, like, makes that episode so funny and so good.
You know the saying, you never forget how to ride a bike? It's not true. Case in point, me. In elementary school, I learned. I knew how to ride a bike. I have a vivid memory of being on my bike, my dad beside me helping keep me up and pedaling faster and faster, and then he lets go and I'm off, riding alone. But then I stopped. Sometime in elementary school, I just stopped riding my bike, never really picked it up again. And in the time since, I've forgotten how to ride. Since moving up to Minneapolis for college, it's become a goal of mine to relearn how to ride a bike. I mean, not knowing how to ride a bike in Minneapolis is just embarrassing. And really, there couldn't be a better city to learn in. In 2015, Minneapolis was named the 18th best city for biking in the world by Copenhagen Zine Design Co., a Danish design company that puts together a list of the best cities for biking annually. So I asked my friend Chris Hines to take me biking to help me learn. And on a perfect Minnesota afternoon, we met up at a house near Lake Harriet to grab a tandem bike older than me because
hey, you got to start somewhere.
I'm a little bit suspecting we're going the wrong way. I'm going to check my phone at the top of the hill. Okay.
After several wrong turns and stops, we finally made it out to Lake Harriet. The lake was beautiful. And after years of traveling only by walking and driving, it was exciting traveling through nature like this. But let's be honest, tandem biking isn't really learning how to ride a bike. So a week later, I went back home to see friends and family, and there I asked my brother Brett to finish up what Chris had started and teach me once and for all how to ride a bike by myself. I asked him if he had any advice.
Pedal. Don't fall over.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Can you grab the bike? So I borrowed my dad's bike and helmet and set out to finally learn the thing that everyone else in the world seemed to know but me. How to ride a bike. The first attempt was a failure, I'll admit. But the second attempt, I got my footing and began flying down the block. It felt exciting after all these years finally relearning how to ride a bike. When people think of riding a bike, they often think of freedom. Now, flying past my old neighborhood, past houses I had seen most of my life, I knew exactly why biking feels like freedom.
I'm sorry to say that Alex is gone. He's not turning back. I fear we may never see him again. Never mind, he turned around.
From Real College Podcast, I'm Alex Schumacher.
Outside of the personal realm, Alex took time to document important issues, especially within the local queer community. His piece on AIDS in the cities is just one example.
Yeah, that was one of the more serious pieces I've done. I don't know, it was sort of like this moment where you learn about this issue that you kind of thought, like, it sort of defined your life in, like, a loose, abstract way, and you kind of thought it had gone away, and then learning that, like, no, it's very, very, very much still here, and still a really big problem, and no one really wants to keep talking. No one wants to talk about it anymore. We all like to think that it's been solved, and it just hasn't. It's actually still a pretty big problem here in the Twin Cities. It's a, we're seeing a big rise of it among the Somali population, and I think I just heard a statistic where, if current trends follow, half of all queer black men will get AIDS in their lifetime. And that's like a horrifying, like, that's a horrifying statistic and a horrifying trend that just kind of snaps into focus how big of a problem AIDS was. And that story kind of just was the center of all that for me. I talked to, so there's the Youth and AIDS Project that is part of the University of Minnesota, and I talked to, ended up using the audio that I got from when I talked to the head of that. I was able to sit down with her, and she's been, like, at the organization for a bunch of years, and she's had, like, a bunch of outreach in, like, the homeless, queer, people of color community. And I also sat down, I think this would be a just an amazing story if someone could do a full story about this group. There is a camp based in Minnesota for kids who have, kids and teenagers who either themselves have AIDS or whose parents have AIDS. And I got to talk to the communications director for that. And that was really cool because essentially I was like, how do you make sure it's affordable? And they're like, well, if they can't afford it, we just get our donors to pay for it. Like it's like, it finance, like, we make sure finances are not a problem for these kids, that they get to come here and feel like everything in their life is normal when sometimes everything doesn't feel normal for them outside of this space. So those are the two interviews I ended up using in that piece. I'm walking into an office building in Midtown Minneapolis to meet with people from the University of Minnesota's Youth and AIDS Project. I wanted to meet with them because they're doing something that most people today, including myself, aren't doing. They're paying attention to AIDS. I became interested in the story after a composer I really respected died earlier this fall due to complications with AIDS.
His name was Michael Friedman. He'd written off-Broadway shows and songs for The New Yorker and This American Life. But like many people today, I had assumed AIDS was a problem of the past and no longer an issue. Friedman's death, however, proved to be a rude awakening that that was not the case. In his early 40s, white and well-off, he did pretty much fit the profile for what I thought AIDS victims looked like. But that assumption proved not to be true either.
Minnesota is one of the whitest states in the union, right? Our African-American, African-born population is 5% of the population here, but 34% of the population that's HIV infected.
That's Valerie Rubin Rashad, the executive director for the Minnesota Youth and AIDS Project, YAP for short. YAP's whole goal is to work with at-risk and HIV-positive youth and get them on a path to stability. But that is harder than it sounds. Rubin Rashad started her career working at a homeless shelter before moving to YAP. But while she changed jobs, the people she was working with didn't change.
I've always worked within the same population of homeless youth, youth who identify as GLBT. It's always kind of been that same loop over the last 30 years. When I was doing street outreach, I was at District 202. A large number of the homeless youth that I was working with, they were exchanging survival sex or a place to stay, a place to eat. And I encountered that when I came over here. It's difficult to maintain viral suppression if you have to bring your pills from place to place and you don't want people to know your status if you're couch hopping. So it's a lot of work in finding places for them to become stably housed. For a majority, they're just trying to survive day to day. So getting them to look at the future, that's kind of where our struggles are.
Housing, healthcare, community. These are all things that not only YAP, but other HIV-focused charities and projects have to work on to get these young people stable and healthy. One Heartland, a charity that runs a camp in Minnesota for HIV-positive youth, or youth whose parents are HIV-positive, works on developing community as a means for fostering stability. I talked with Jill Rudolph, the National Camp Director for One Heartland, about what this sense of community gives these young people.
Like it's just quiet here. They can talk about it all they want. Some come and don't mention it at all. And I think that's a really special part of One Heartland is we allow them to have a camp experience that they want. If they want to talk about it, we're willing to have that conversation and really have an understanding and walk them through that process. But if they don't and they just want to come and do canoeing and fishing and see their friends and reconnect and do the crazy games at night, then they can do that.
Piece by piece, brick by brick, groups like YAP and One Heartland help these young people that the rest of us have forgotten. And despite all the obstacles, even in the hardest cases, Rubin Rashad finds that they're able to get these young people stable.
There's some times where I'm like, oh my God, are they going to make it? They do make it, and they do survive, and they go on to have families. They go on to get married. They go on to have their own apartments and graduate college and have jobs that are really sustaining them and fulfilling them. I still have some that struggle, but they're here, and they're still alive, and they have a purpose in this world. I've been there at the birth of my clients' babies, and I've had two named after me. I said, are you sure?
From Real College Podcast, I'm Alex Schumacher.
Alex's most recent piece, and one of my favorites of his, falls into a similar vein to his AIDS piece and other stories that he's done.
Yeah, I guess following the AIDS piece, the two things I feel like I've done most of my stories on at RCP have been like sort of personal essay and then like queer stories. And then this is like sort of like the meeting point of the two. So specifically, I found it when I've been volunteering at the Jean Nicholas Treader Collection here at U of M, which is an LGBT archive, one of the few in the country that's housed at a university. And I was rummaging through some KFAI material, and I saw this poster that was like, come hang out at Bear Speech, because it was just like one of their like get-together type things. And I was like, what is this? What is Bear Bottom Beach? And I did some quick Googling, and I found out that it was this huge cruising location in the Twin Cities back in like the 80s and 90s. And just because of the way the cultures changed, it was not even a thing I'd ever heard about or knew of. And I can spot a great story when I see one. This is going to be a fun, fabulous story. I'm going to take some like fellow reporters out, and we're going to find Bear Bottom Beach. And I sat down with like my source, learned it was more than one beach, as the piece kind of went along, I kind of found that there was like this thing that I thought was going to be the simple, fun, sort of silly story sort of became more about the way things disappear and are forgotten over time. Mm-hmm. It's like not the direction I wanted the story to go, but it was a really cool direction for the story that end up taking.
The story came to me while I was digging through a box of old KFII promotional material. In the box, there was a flyer advertising a get-together at a place called Bear Bottom Beach. Well, actually, it's not called Bear Bottom Beach, but it's actually called I Can't Say on the Air because there's a swear word in it. Anyways, you get the picture. I came across this flyer, and I was like, what is this place? And after doing a quick Google search, I learned that Bear Bottom Beach was an old cruising spot located in the Twin Cities. And cruising, for those of you who don't know, is
when people solicit sex with no money involved in public with each other. That's the most kind of bare bones way you can say it, and it's especially among gay men and bisexual men.
That's Myra Billen-Phibbs, a student at the University of Minnesota who's done oral history research on the cruising scene in the Twin Cities during the 70s and 80s. When I first conceived of this story, I thought it'd be a fun way to try to connect with a queer past that I knew nothing about. And so, after learning about Bear Bottom Beach, I decided I would go out and find it.
I will talk about Bear Beach, and I want to talk about the fact that there are three places that have been known as Bear Beach.
As it turned out, not only was I wrong in thinking that there was only one Bear Bottom Beach, but the beach that I knew the most about, a sandy strip along the Mississippi, no longer even existed. The other two, however, were still around, and Myra told me more about them.
The second Bear Beach was on Twin Lake in Golden Valley, so in the suburbs, but close to town. To get to that beach, you'd have to go through a thicket, like a big piece of woods, and there was a little path that went through. I haven't been there, but I hear that it's going strong, so that's still very much a place. The third one is really short. Hidden Beach on Cedar Lake, which is now like an official city beach, used to have to go through the woods to get there. Now there's a road and a porta potty, and it's like an official thing. But it used to be you had to walk through this path that was like as narrow as a person, all the way through these woods, and then you would get to the tiny beach there. That historically, until they cleared it out, was a nude beach.
I still wanted to visit Bear Bottom Beach. And even with one taken away by the river, I decided I would visit the two that still existed, even if they weren't what they once were. And so, on one of the first truly beautiful days of spring, me, Nathan, Hannah, and Tosin decided to trek out into the city and find Bear Bottom Beach. We started with Hidden Beach on Cedar Lake.
A dog is having the time of its life.
Since it was beautiful out, the beach was filled with couples, kids, friends, and dogs enjoying the day. But the beach's history as a gay nudist beach was gone. In its place, just as Myra had said, the city had put up picnic tables and cleared away the trees. I knew that the beach had been claimed by the city, but still, actually seeing it made me feel weird. After standing around for a bit, we went back to the car and drove off to the third Bear Bottom Beach. Just as Myra had said, we found a dirt trail leading through the trees that went down to Twin Lake. But Along the way, I noticed that there were signs marking the trail. After about 5 minutes wandering through the forest, we finally reached the beach, and just like before, there are people out there enjoying the beautiful day. On one end of the beach, there was a group of aging bikers hugging and cracking open cold drinks. On another end of the beach, a group of teenagers were lounging in hammocks and blasting music. But just like the last beach, it didn't really feel like this was a queer space. It felt like a beach.
The kind of great untold part of the story of downtown Minneapolis is like regeneration or like gentrification. The sexual spaces are curiously left out of all of those histories, but they played a huge role. And that's what I found in my research.
If Bear Bottom Beach has, as I fear, disappeared as a queer space, then it is just another lost queer space within the larger history of the Twin Cities. As me and Myra talked, she told me about how, as part of an effort to rebuild downtown, queer businesses were forced out and destroyed.
The fact that these businesses existed in these spaces, so crucial corner lots on Hennepin, 8th and Hennepin, 7th and Hennepin, 6th and Hennepin, that are now worth millions of dollars, big warehouses that are now worth millions of dollars and are full of restaurants and boutiques and luxury lofts, these spaces in the 60s, 70s, and 80s were occupied by shady, dirty, disreputable, gay public sexual businesses, commercial sex businesses. So we're talking about 3 bathhouses on Hennepin or near Hennepin. We're talking about, I think, 6 or 7 porn bookstores on, I think, 9 blocks in Hennepin, 3 or 4 porn theaters downtown. It took up a lot of the Hennepin Strip. What that did was it drove the property values to nothing. The buildings weren't worth anything because they were all, I mean, what is a bathhouse worth at the end of it? Most of them get either completely gutted or the buildings get destroyed, which is what happened to 315 North First. In 1988, it got bought out by BSR Properties. The developer specifically said, "We're sandblasting the whole building, down to the brick. There's nothing to save in there." Well, that building, if you look at the property tax returns on the Hennepin County like database, those buildings that the bathhouses and the porn stores were in, they're easily each worth $3 to $50 million each business. And gradually, as the 80s and the 90s wore on, through, and I want to really like drive this home, through very specific and intentional policies that the city put in place, they wanted to redevelop downtown to attract wealthy people, and that's what's happened.
When I began this story, I thought it would be a fun, sort of silly story about going out into the woods and trying to find a beach. I didn't think it would become a bummer about how gentrification has and continues to take away spaces from minority groups. There's a positive spin I can put on all this. It's that we don't have to let lost spaces go unreplaced. Even if we can't get that specific place back, we can build new. We can make a new Bear Bottom Beach. For Real College Podcast, I'm Alex Schumacher.
The last thing I asked Alex was what he would miss most about RCP.
Things I'm going to miss most about RCP, the community. I like the group of volunteers and producers has always been one of the biggest draws about RCP for me. Also just like the creativity of it. I don't know. There's something, you can produce really weird things when you're spending 9 hours alone in a dark room trying to turn out a podcast piece. And I don't know, there's not many places in life where you get to kind of create something so strange and unique. And yeah, I think I'm going to miss that and the community here the most.
Alex, we'll miss your compassion as a boss, your kindly worded emails, and your impeccable skills at drawing together episode themes from leftover scraps. Good luck out there. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Ben Hallam, Liv Riggins, Lizzie Ritchie, and as of this week, Tassin Fasimo. I'm Nathan Fervoy, your host and managing editor. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online at radiok.org or on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Follow us on Instagram for a look behind the scenes. And thanks for listening.
Should I say it? From Real College Podcast, this is Alex Schumacher.
I'll probably whisper to myself. Goodbye. Ha ha ha.
off into the night he goes. All right, cool.